Okay, I left the map of Paul's third journey on the board, even though we pretty much completed that last week. They are back. He and his traveling companions reported back to the Church of Jerusalem in Acts 21 and 17. After being warned, they landed at Tyre, and then went down to Caesarea. But as we ended last week, if you remember, Agabus came and prophesied by the Holy Spirit that Paul would be bound whenever he reached Jerusalem, and not to go. But he didn't tell him not to go. But he had been forbidden to go for a few days. And then after Agabus gave him the warning that he would be bound, they went ahead and went. In chapter 21, verse 14, his companions pretty much gave up trying to persuade him not to go. And so they arrived in Jerusalem, and in verse 17, went into the church and reported again how the Gentiles had received the word and how Paul had preached. And this was a major issue in those days. This was the changing of their culture. Those Jews and Gentiles and Christianity, was all of that was all mixed in together, and it was a great thing that some of them could not accept, and some had trouble accepting, and some didn't. So in any case, we're going to try to not get too bogged down today, because we've just got today and next Sunday. But today we'll spend talking about the period of Paul in Jerusalem and Caesarea before they set off to Rome, which is where was the last we hear of Paul is at Rome, but years later. And so this is not really a period of missionary travel, but it is of Paul's life. And I think I said last week, after Paul arrived in Jerusalem, if you look about verse 26 of chapter 21, Paul and some men were, other men were, took an oath, a vow, and this was to show some of the Jews that Paul did not have any. Paul was not teaching that they could not keep Jewish holidays, but they were not to be religious holidays. And this was, as I understand it, pretty much just a something that Paul did that he didn't have to do, kind of like having Timothy circumcised. But it helped other people understand he was not against the law of Moses, just like Christ wasn't, but it had been fulfilled. Christ didn't condemn the law of Moses. He fulfilled it. It was over with and done with whenever the church was established. But Christ kept the law of Moses in his lifetime. Okay, and so we see that when Paul entered the temple, this, I think, as far as I can tell, was the last time Paul was a free man. He was arrested, put in chains, and as we'll see today, he was kept in chains. Sometimes literally, sometimes I think he was loosed from his chains, but he was still under guard, or you might say under house arrest. We know that was the case at Rome for about 2 years. And many times he was, we might call, loosely guarded. You might call him a trustee, because it became evident very quickly to Paul's captors, whoever was in charge of his being his guard, that Paul wasn't going to try to escape. In fact, Paul, his Christianity, his being, people came in awe of that, even the Romans. And they realized there was something about this man that was completely different than any prisoner they'd ever had before, other than Christ, if they had been in the presence of Christ. Okay. So, I'm just going to kind of skip through a few things here. I don't want to get too bogged down, but in chapter 21 again there, verse 27, these Jews from Asia came to Jerusalem, saw him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd, and laid hands on him. And they start this whole thing all over again. And they thought that Paul had brought this Trophimus, who had traveled with him, who was a Greek. They had seen him with Paul in the city somewhere, and so they jumped to conclusions and thought that he had brought this Trophimus apparently into the Jewish part of the temple, which was a big no-no for the Jews, and that really stirred people up. In verse 30, the whole city was disturbed. Verse 31, they were seeking to kill him. They just went off the deep end. They didn't try to justify anything by the law. They just at this point, were going to try to kill him. And so the commander of the garrison, the Roman commander, he finds out about this big uproar in Jerusalem, that the whole town's in uproar, so he goes down to stop stuff. He gets his soldiers, it says, took soldiers and centurions and went down to them. And they were, verse 32, the Jews were actually beating Paul at that time. So they were probably in the process of killing him. And so to get to the end of this section, verse 40, the last verse of this chapter, this centurion gives Paul the opportunity, and he rescues him from the crowd so they wouldn't kill him. And Paul tells him who he is. He says, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, and I would like to speak. I want to speak to everyone. And so he gives him, he tells him, okay, you can. And he speaks to the centurion in Greek, which is what the Romans spoke. And then he goes to addressing the Jewish crowd. What did they speak? They spoke the Hebrew. They were Jews. So we know that he knew at least two languages. And so Paul gives his testimony, we might call that, again. He's told this story countless times in his life and will continue to tell it. And so I'm not going to go through all that, but he tells about how he's a Pharisee. He persecuted Christians. He was struck down by the light from heaven. He was converted, and he went to the Gentiles preaching that Christ that walked among them was the Messiah. Any thoughts before I move on? Pretty straightforward. Okay, and so verse 21 of chapter 22, when he tells these Hebrews, these Jews, when he says that God told him, that Jesus told him, I'm going to send you to the Gentiles, oh, they just blew their top. They couldn't stand that. You got to be kidding me. The Gentiles, we're God's chosen people. And you're a Jew, and you're going to Gentiles and condemning us? And so, verse 22, they tried to kill him again. It says they tore their clothes and threw dust in the air. We know that the tearing of the clothes was a common ritual for sorrow or hatred or these types of emotions. The dust in the air, I'm not sure what that, I guess that's the same thing, I don't know. We know they used to put on sackcloth and rub ashes on their skin, on their face. Maybe the dust in the air is the same as the ashes, I don't know. But they made their faces probably appear black. And so the commander decides, okay, I'm gonna take you and scourge you, which would be torture, which would be whipping, to get the truth out of you. I want to know what's going on here. He was a Roman. He was confused. He didn't know what this whole thing was all about. He was probably looking for some type of secular crime. In other words, has he killed somebody? Has he stole something from somebody? Has he robbed someone? But no, it's simply a matter of disagreement over religion. We might might be called philosophy, different views. And so Paul says, time out here. He says, is it lawful for you to whip me? He says, I'm a Roman. And the commander says, whoa, you are? He says, I'm a Roman, but I had to buy my citizenship. See, there's different ways you could become a Roman. Well, Paul wasn't born in Rome. He wasn't born in Italy. So how was he a Roman?
He was born in a city that was a Roman city.
Right.
He was born in that city was Roman.
Right. It's kind of like America. If you're born here legally, then you're legally an American. He was born legally in a city that had been conquered by the Romans, and the Caesars had decreed in this particular city, if you were born there, you were now a Roman citizen. That wasn't the case with all cities that they conquered. But where he was born, and I forget the name of the town, it's not Tarsus. I know he's called Saul of Tarsus. Cilicia, I believe. If you look at chapter 23, verse 34. Huh?
22 and 3.
Yeah. Well, I guess he was born in Tarsus. Tarsus was a... I got ahead of myself. Tarsus is a town in the province or the area, state, whatever you want to call it, of Cilicia. So I believe he was born in Tarsus. By name? I don't know. Do we have a record of that? I don't know.
The only time he mentions them is in talking about his genealogy. He says he's from the tribe of Benjamin. So, So his father was a Jew, and his mother most certainly was, or he wouldn't have been allowed to be a parent.
They were the strictest sect.
You know, it's interesting, Paul here twice says what city he's from. Once to the commander, right, in chapter 21. Then to the people in verse 22. And I guess either it's a different person, and they just didn't, or they maybe didn't make the connection that he's from Tarsus, which means he's a Jew. I mean, which means he's a Roman. You couldn't defeat him without him being condemned.
Yeah.
They don't make that connection until Paul points it out.
Right. Because if the commander had scourged him and he was a Roman, then the commander was in big trouble. And so he paid attention when Paul said that. Even if Paul had been lying, he didn't want to make that mistake. And so, verse 29, chapter 22, verse 29, or verse 28, Paul says, but I was born a citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. And why was he afraid? Because he had arrested him. Because they didn't have an accusation of a crime. It was just these people saying, he's preaching this Jesus. Well, Jesus didn't mean anything to the Romans. Paul hadn't been accused of killing anybody or robbing anybody or whatever. Just some religious disagreement. And they didn't want anything to do with that. They just wanted peace and order. Okay. And so, verse 30, the next day, because he wanted to know for certain, this would be the commander, why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds. Well, maybe he was set free, but he was released from his chains, but he wasn't free to go. And commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. So here's Paul. He brings him down before the Sanhedrin, I believe that it is. And to give his defense to them. not the mob of people that were trying to kill him. And until this whole mess is over with, Paul goes before one ruler, then he goes before another ruler. He's back and forth from Caesarea to Jerusalem. They just knock him around like a ping pong ball, and he's not discouraged at any time. He just uses every opportunity he has to tell the story of how he was converted and what people need to do to be saved. And so then we have this little chapter 23. We have this run-in between Ananias, the supposed high priest, and Paul. And Paul starts out his speech saying, "I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." Well, you can imagine how Ananias thought about that. Here's supposedly the head honcho of the Jews, the religious leader of the Jews, and Paul, who used to be a Jew, who used to get his authority from the same people to persecute Christians, is saying, "I'm doing what's right, and I have my whole life." And Ananias looking at him say, "How can that be? You used to work for us. Now you're against us." Well, the key there is, "I have lived in all good conscience." Yes, his actions were different. But if we don't have the right information and our conscience does not condemn us, does that mean we're doing the right thing? It does not. And Paul was proof of that. He thought he was doing the right thing, but he was not, and that's why God appeared to him and changed him. And so Ananias tells someone standing by Paul to strike him in the mouth, and Paul calls him a whitewashed wall. Well, what does that mean? Yeah, you're a hypocrite. And actually, the words before that, "God will strike you." We might say, "God will strike you, you hypocrite." What happened to Ananias was he was assassinated shortly thereafter. Now, it may have been, I forget what that said. I read on that. It may have been a year or so, but he was assassinated. And he had a very wicked past. So in any case, they got this straightened out, and Paul started out talking, and I don't know if he did it on purpose or not. I don't think he did, but he said, I'm a Pharisee, and you know that the Pharisees believe in the resurrection, they believe in angels, and they believe in spirits, and Sadducees do not. Well, there were Sadducees present, so they all get into it. They start fighting amongst each other. So the whole thing starts all over again. Verse 10, this great dissension, and this commander takes Paul for his own safekeeping and puts him in the barracks or the castle, and probably in chains.
This is like the equivalent of if we got in a bad way, we saw that half the group was Republicans and half the group are Democrats. We'd say, "Well, I'm being condemned because I'm a Republican."
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly what Paul does here.
Yeah.
He sees that some of them are Sadducees and some of them are
Pharisees,
and so he used that to his advantage.
Yeah.
But it'd be the kind of modern equivalent of us doing that.
And to the Jews, this was an offense worthy of death, because their religion was their secular law also. The Romans could care less, huh?
But notice like how half of them, though, the Pharisees,
oh, yeah,
they flipped, right?
Yeah.
Well, no longer is it important to defend the law. Now it's important to defend our sect.
Yeah.
Is there any thought on back to the fifth verse where he says that he didn't know the high priest, Ananias?
He didn't know he was the high priest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, why wouldn't he know?
Well, I think there's maybe two reasons. One is, and they were not supposed to do this, but every other year or every second year, they would trade off. Someone else would take the high priest job, That was not supposed to be. Aaron didn't do that when he became the first high priest. And the other thing was, and I didn't jot this information down, but I read that Ananias had done something and apparently been stripped of his power before and had come back to power, and Paul knew about this, which is why he's saying, you know, who do you think you are? You sit to judge me according to the law and command me to be struck contrary to the law. It says you're violating the law that you're supposed to stand for. Okay. So let's. So Paul, verse 11, the Spirit came to Paul when he was that night under arrest. It says, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for that you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." Paul probably thought this might have been the end for him, but he found out he's going to survive this. He's going to go to Rome. Then there was 40 Jews that made an oath that they were going to kill him. That did not happen. Paul's nephew heard about it, and the commander sent him by night with hundreds of soldiers to Caesarea. Is that right? It is, isn't it? Back to Caesarea. So he just came from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Now he's going back to Caesarea, and he writes a letter, and this commander's name here in verse 22 is Claudius Lysias. And his letter begins in verse 26 to Felix. Says, this man was seized by the Jews, was about to be killed. I rescued him. So I'm sending him to you to hold until his accusers come before you and make formal charges. In other words, we've just got a bunch of yelling and screaming going on here in Jerusalem, and most people don't even know what's happening, and we need to straighten this out. Yeah, about their law. It really was a petty thing to the Romans. They just wanted things to calm down. Okay, and then in verse 33, they come to Caesarea. They present Paul, and when Felix reads the letter, he says, "Where are you from?" He says, "From Cilicia." He says, "Okay, I will hear you when your accusers also have come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. So at least he did the right thing of saying, "Well, we're going to get all the parties together and we'll have a trial or a hearing then." All right. So 5 days later, here comes Ananias again, and this time he's got his buddy Tertullus. Tertullus was this orator. So they went out and got him a hired gun to come and plead their case for him. And the first thing he does is kiss up to Felix. "Oh, Felix, you're so wonderful." We can read that starting in verse 2. You know, he's telling this Roman, "Oh, we've got such great prosperity and peace because of you, Felix. You're so noble and so wonderful. And we don't want to be tedious, but I beg of you, just hear a few things from us." Then in verse 5, he starts telling lies. "This man's a plague." So on, he says, verse 6, he tried to profane the temple. We talked about that. "And we wanted to judge him according to our law, but Commander Lysias came and with great violence took him out of our hands. And has commanded us to come to you. So here we are." And all the Jews agreed, "Yeah, that's true." Well, first of all, what is it? You know, they're just repeating the same thing. The Romans care less about, the only thing they care about is the dissension. They care less about the religion of the Jews. And once again, did not accuse him of a crime, a physical crime, according to the Romans. Okay, and then verse 10, Paul is given permission to speak by Felix. and in a nutshell, tells his story again. And he says in verse 17, after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation. This is after all of his third missionary journeys. Okay? After these are all complete, he's come back to Jerusalem. And in the midst of, verse 18, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor tumult. I didn't come start any problems. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves, meaning Ananias and Tertullus and anyone with them, say if they have found any wrongdoing in the while I stood before the council. He says, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. Or in other words, because I'm a Pharisee and I believe in the resurrection and I believe in Jesus Christ, that's why I'm here today.
When he mentioned that I bring alms to you, is this when he brought the gifts from those in Macedonia to the four saints?
Well, alms is money. So it's. I'm not sure, Dwayne. But he had brought it to them. Okay, so Paul gets bounced around again after Felix hears all of this. He says, "Well, when I'll have Lysias, I'll have him come over too, and then we'll make a decision." Does this sound like our court system today? Yeah. Just bounce the ball over to somebody else and no one really takes responsibility for a disposition in the case or actually deciding what's right. So, verse 23, here's what I talked about before. He commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. So how much liberty he had, we don't really know, but he wasn't, apparently, during the time he waited for Lysias to show up, he was not chained down. Well, when did Lysias come? He didn't. And if you look at verse 27, he was there 2 years. And finally, this Porcius Festus takes over Felix's job. He gets to be the big shot. I skipped something here. This tells us what kind of a person Felix is. Verse 24, after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was also Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. He reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come. Felix was afraid, and I think that word means trembled. If you look that up, he was physically afraid because of his past life. He says, go away now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. Verse 26, he also hoped that Paul would pay him off, give him a bribe. So he kept calling for him at different times.
So things haven't changed.
No. Sure had. So Paul was, I don't know if we could call this a house arrest or not, but he was not free to go, but he may have been free to move around the compound where he was at least, for about 2 years. And so Felix, just to stay on the Jews' good side, left him under arrest whenever Festus took over.
You know, 2 years is quite a bit of time on it for a while. And we don't hear anything about what Paul did.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was writing on some of these letters or epistles. You know, we always have the prison ones thinking they came from Rome. But I just wonder, what was he doing there? I know he was working.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt every day he was laboring. And you would think if there were conversions and stuff, there may have been conversions, but if there were notable things happening, you would think that Luke would have recorded them. Okay, I want to get through part of chapter 25 here so we can finish next week, unless you have a thought or a question. Okay, so Festus takes over, and what was the Roman capital of Palestine?
Caesarea.
Who were the rulers of Rome? What was their names? They were Caesars. That's the easy way to remember it. Caesarea. If you're a big shot, you get a town named after you, huh? So I'll have my town in your country, and we'll call it by my name. Caesar, Caesarea. Caesarea, however you want to pronounce it. And so, after 3 days, Festus comes to Jerusalem. And so the high priest and all these chief people of the Jews, Paul's accusers, they come up to him and they want to say, bring Paul down to Jerusalem. He says, bring him down here and let's try him down here. Well, they really were going to kill him along the way. And Festus says, verse 4, no, he's at Caesarea and I'm going back there. And he says, if you want to accuse him, you come up to Caesarea. And so, verse 6, he stayed in Jerusalem about 10 days or so, and then went back to Caesarea. And the very next day, verse 6, says he commanded Paul to be brought out. So he wanted to know what was going on here. He wanted to find out this or maybe clear it up. And Paul answered and said, I haven't been accused, verse 8, of anything against the law of the Jews. The temple, I have done nothing. I have not offended Caesar. And Festus says, well, you want to go to Jerusalem and be judged there? And Paul says, nope. And he says, I'll go to Caesar. He says, I've been here for 2 years. I'll just go up to the big dog and we'll go there. Well, where was Caesar at? In Rome. And since Paul was a Roman citizen, by making that request, he tied the hands of anybody that held him. They had to let him go. It was out of their hands, and probably they were glad of that. They were probably glad to hear that. And Paul says in verse 11, if I'm an offender or committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there's nothing to their claims, then I appeal to Caesar. And I'll prove it. In verse 12, Paul said, Festus says, you've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go. All right. But it wasn't over yet. Paul was still, he was still the ping pong ball back here in Caesarea. He's gonna now appear before Agrippa and Festus. This Agrippa, I believe, is Herod Agrippa II. Right, Ben? You just had explained to us several of the different Herods.
Yeah, I think this is the great-grandson of Herod the Great, the one that killed the children.
Who was in power when Jesus was born.
It's either great-grandson or great-great-grandson.
Okay. And isn't it also right that there were, at times there may have been more than one Herod, which is the same as a Caesar, in power at the same time in different areas?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not like, even if he was the great-grandson, it's not like we might think of four generations later, because Paul lived in the same generation as Christ. So
that's why, like, there's Herod the Tetrarch, because he only ruled like a quarter of the kingdom or something like that. Uh-huh. I can't remember all that details.
Yeah. Okay, but this is Herod Agrippa II, who is part Jewish. And I think Dwayne mentioned the other day he may have been half Jewish, but he was part Jew, part Gentile. And in any case, he comes to Caesarea to greet Festus. check on something here. Okay. I can't find what I was looking for. But is this Bernice? Who is Bernice?
Sister.
Is his sister. Why would you bring your sister? Why would you travel with your sister in a official capacity to come and meet this? Well, some historians say that it is not only his sister, but it is his wife to whom he was not married, his illegitimate partner. And in any case, they, as we might say, certainly put on airs, put on the dog, and they came there. Verse 14, they'd been there many days, and Festus laid out his case, laid this out before Herod Agrippa. Well, why did he do all this? Paul had already appealed to Caesar, and he said, "You're going to go to Caesar. So why go through with all this?" Yeah.
And maybe he's trying to find a way around Paul's request to go to Caesar.
The simple, easy explanation is politics. Yeah. There may have been more than just one reason, but I think that's the main one. And he says, there's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix. The Jews have accused him. They're wanting a judgment against him. And I said, verse 16, it's not the custom of the Romans to put a man to death before he meets his accusers face to face. And so he tells the story of this previous trial. Verse 17, therefore they came together without any delay. I would command him to be brought up. And he says, I think the whole thing's just a big brouhaha over this Jesus. That verse 19, a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. He says, I'm not familiar with the Jews' religion and all of these things. But he knew that, I'm sure he knew that Agrippa was part Jewish, and Agrippa would probably have a better understanding of the Jews. And so Agrippa says in verse 22, well, I'll hear him. I'd like to listen to this. And so verse 23, there's the verse I was looking for. The next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city. At Festus' command, Paul was brought in. So you can just imagine the big show that went on here. And so, Festus introduces basically Paul to Agrippa, and then we'll take up next week, chapter 26. Agrippa gives Paul permission to speak, and Paul tries to convert him too. We're about out of time here. Any other thoughts or questions before we close?